organizational skills because she was the one who put together the whole workshop. So thank you very much for doing that.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. So as Rosario said, my name is Lisa Goldman Rosas, and I'm going to be presenting the results from our binational study looking at food insecurity and dietary intake, as well as weight status among children of Mexican descent. And before I go on, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Lynette Neufeld at the National Institute of Public Health, Dr. Sylvia Gendelman, right here, Dr. Leah Fernald, and Brenda Eskenazi at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. I have no financial relationships to disclose. Okay, so household food insecurity can be defined as limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods, or the inability to acquire foods in a socially acceptable way. It's approximately 11% prevalence among U.S. households, and the prevalence is about twice as high among Mexican-American households in the United States. Although there have been few studies conducted on household food insecurity in Mexico, one study of Mexico City school children found that about 40% of households were food insecure. Another study in more rural areas of the state of Jalisco found that almost all households were food insecure. So although food insecurity is common among Mexican-American households in the U.S. and among Mexicans in Mexico, there have been relatively few studies looking at the dietary consequences in this population, with a few notable exceptions right there on the slide. One of these studies by Kaiser et al. Looked at among Mexican-American households in California, compared children who were household food insecure and food secure, and found that those children in households that were food insecure consumed less servings of some food groups in the U.S. food guide pyramid. A paradoxical association of food insecurity and obesity has been observed in some studies of adult women and a few studies of children. Now, there are several possible mechanisms for this association. One could be a dependence on low-cost, energy-dense foods, which could result in increases in adiposity. Alternatively, periodic cycles of hunger and then overeating could also lead to overweight. And finally, periods of hunger could also lead to metabolic changes, whereby the body becomes actually more efficient in its use of energy, and weight gain could occur. So the studies on food insecurity in children are very mixed, as you can see from this table. Some studies show an increased risk for weight status, other studies show a decreased risk, and still others show absolutely no association. So our studies will build on this work by focusing on children of Mexican descent who are disproportionately affected by both food insecurity and overweight, as you've heard from the previous presenters, and we'll also be taking a binational perspective so that we can simultaneously understand the effects of food insecurity in Mexico and the U.S. So our research questions were to look at the associations of food insecurity and dietary intake, as well as overweight, among a population of 5-year-old children of Mexican descent residing in California and Mexico. We further investigated whether these associations differed by place of residence, California or Mexico, because we felt that a deeper understanding of the effects of food insecurity could be found by understanding the Mexican context. To answer our research questions, we conducted a binational study made up of two cross-sectional samples of Mexican mothers and their 5-year-old children. The mothers and 5-year-old children in California came from the Chamaco sample, Center for the Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas, which is a longitudinal cohort study located in a primarily farm worker Mexican immigrant community in California. Approximately 85% of this cohort were Mexican-born and were included in the present analysis. The sample size is around 300, depending on which analysis I present to you today. Mothers and children from Mexico were participants in the Proyecto Mariposa study. And Proyecto Mariposa was designed to capture a similar sample to the Chamacos group, with the exception that they still lived in Mexico. So the most common states of origin of the Chamacos mothers were Guanajuato, Jalisco, and Michoacán. Therefore, we recruited the Proyecto Mariposa mothers from high migration municipalities in those three states. Both samples were recruited through clinics, and were receiving government benefits. In California, the majority of mothers, around 97%, were receiving women, infant, and children coupons. And all of the participants in Proyecto Mariposa in Mexico were recipients of Oportunidades, the Mexican federal social welfare program that Sylvia previously mentioned. Household food insecurity was assessed through an in-person interview in both California and Mexico. We used the U.S. Department of Agricultural Household Food Security Scale and classified families as food secure, food insecure without hunger, or the more severe form of food insecurity with hunger. These classifications are based on statements like you can see on this slide: the food we bought just didn't last and we didn't have money to get more. Or questions such as, did adults in your household ever cut the size of meals or skip meals because there was not enough food? Anthropometrics were assessed using identical protocols in each site. We calculated body mass index and compared children's BMI with sex-specific BMI for age percentiles from the CDC in 2000. We classified all children as normal weight, at risk for overweight, or overweight according to the criteria you can see on the slide. To characterize children's diet, we looked at their total energy intake, nutrient intake, as well as their intake of several food groups. Today, I'm just going to be presenting the nutrients and the food group analysis. We assessed dietary intake using different food frequency questionnaires in each site. We chose the most appropriate food frequency questionnaire for each sample. So, for example, in California, we used the Harvard Service Food Frequency Questionnaire for Hispanic children. And in Mexico, we used a food frequency questionnaire developed by the Instituto Nacional de Salud Pública. Both questionnaires had the same structure, identical response options, but had different food items in some cases. So this table presents the sociodemographic characteristics of both the California and Mexico samples. You can see that the majority of mothers in both samples were overweight or obese, although this was a little more common in California. And then you can see the different mothers' years in the US below. 56% of the population in California had been in the United States for about 5 to 10 years at the time of this interview, or 0 to 5 years at the time the child was born. And in Mexico, you can see that 44% of the mothers reported that a close family member was currently in the United States for work. And incidentally, California was the most common state of origin that was mentioned. To determine the association of food security and dietary intake, we excluded children with implausible total energy intake values, transformed dietary variables to approximate a normal distribution, and used ANOVA to test for differences. I'll be presenting the analysis stratified by place of residence, California or Mexico, because of significant interaction. Okay, so household food insecurity was significantly more prevalent in Mexico than in California. You can see California in the blue with 39%, so that 29% and 10% added together, reporting some degree of food insecurity in the last 12 months. Mexico in the green, you can see that about 3/4 of the mothers reported some degree of food insecurity as well. Although it was much higher in Mexico than in California, you can see that the prevalence of food insecurity in California was still higher than national averages here in the United States for non-Hispanic whites as well as for Mexican Americans. This slide shows median daily energy and nutrient intakes of fat, saturated fat, carbohydrates, and protein by food security status. I'm showing you both the adjusted and the unadjusted ANOVA results. So in the adjusted, we included SES, maternal education, whether or not they're receiving some sort of food assistance, such as WIC or food stamps, and if the mother was currently working in farm work. Controlling for some variables like SES could be considered over-controlling in this case, so I wanted to show you both. You can see that for energy, fat, and saturated fat, children in the food insecure households consumed higher levels of energy, fat, and saturated fat. And this was significant for fat and saturated fat in the adjusted analysis. And the differences are actually quite large in some cases, such as 61 grams of fat for the food secure families, food secure children, and 71 for the food insecure. Okay, so these are the results for the Mexican children, which are quite different. Again, we have daily nutrient intake and energy levels according to food security status. And again, here I have the ANOVA and adjusted ANOVA results. And you can see here that children from food insecure households consumed lower levels of energy and fewer carbohydrates than children from food secure households, although just the association with carbohydrates persisted in the adjusted analysis. So opposite direction. Okay, now I'm gonna present the results of our analysis with food groups. I'm only gonna show the association of the food groups where it was significant with food security status. So first you can see here for the California group, the sweets and snacks were higher for the children in food insecure households compared to food secure households. So those are the median times per day the mothers reported that their children ate some form of sweets and snacks. So this could account for some of the higher energy and fat intakes that we saw in the food insecure children. Sweets and snacks included foods like cakes, cookies, candies, chips, things like that. Okay, now for the Mexican sample, we saw lower intakes of food groups such as meat, dairy, and fruit for those in the food insecure families, so in the opposite direction, although only the association with dairy persisted in our adjusted analysis. And again, we adjusted for the same variables that I mentioned before. Okay, so moving on to weight status, we use logistic regression to investigate the association of food insecurity and overweight status. Because there were few overweight children in the Mexico sample, as you'll see in a second, we combined the at-risk for overweight and overweight categories for this analysis. And again, here I'll be presenting the analysis stratified by sample because of significant interaction by place of residence. Okay, you can see on this slide the weight status categories for California in blue and Mexico in green. Approximately one-third of the California children were classified as overweight or above the 95th percentile, while only 7% of the Mexico children. And when we combine the at-risk for overweight category and overweight categories, the difference is even more striking, with over half of the California children being classified as at-risk for overweight or overweight, compared to only 15% of the Mexico children. This table presents the results of our adjusted logistic regression analysis, looking at food insecurity and weight status. So we have California there on the right and Mexico on the left. As you can see, we found no association between food insecurity and weight status in the California sample. However, in the Mexico sample, we found that food insecurity was associated with an increased odds of overweight or at risk for overweight, with an odds ratio of 3.8. And that's adjusted for mother's weight status, sex, and socioeconomic status. So just to summarize our findings that were kind of contradictory in some cases, I'll walk you through. So in California, which you can see there on the right-hand side, we found that food insecurity was associated with increased intake of energy, fat, sweets, and snacks, with the significant associations in bold. However, even though you might think that those foods would be associated with increase in overweight, we found no association between food security status and weight status in this sample. Now, this could be because of the very high prevalence of overweight in the sample, or perhaps because it was a very homogeneous population, all being recruited from a low-income migrant farm worker community in California. Okay, in Mexico, we had very different results. Food insecurity was associated with lower intake of energy, carbohydrates, and several food groups, again, with the significant associations in the adjusted analysis in bold. However, in this population, we did observe a significant association between being at risk for overweight or overweight and food insecurity. So some of those hypotheses or possible mechanisms that I mentioned earlier related to periodic bouts of hunger and perhaps overeating, or even periodic bouts of hunger and then metabolic changes that might lead to more energy conservation could be responsible for these associations that we observe. So stepping back a little bit to think about what this all means, I think, you know, one of the most striking and important results that came out of this is that these are two very similar groups of mothers and five-year-old children in California and Mexico, and the main difference between them being one has migrated to the U.S. and one hasn't. So thinking about all of the environmental effects that that implies and how that is probably related to why we're seeing such higher levels of overweight here. At the same time, I think that the associations that we observed with food insecurity and diet in both countries can really help food nutrition policymakers in each place be more informed about the policies we can make to improve diet and weight status for both groups in a binational effort. Before I end, I want to really thank all of our funders, especially UC Mexis and the Health Initiative of the Americas, for their funding. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. And finally, we are going to ask our discussant, Gail Woodward, to present some of the conclusions and to moderate the question and answer session, please.
Thank you very much, Rosario and Lisa, for inviting me to this session. And good afternoon to everyone here in the audience. I have the somewhat daunting, but I think fun task of trying to integrate some of these findings, synthesize them, and come to some conclusions regarding policy. The fun part is that I get to jump to conclusions, so I don't have to just stick to our scientific group was very good at not going too beyond the research findings, but I definitely will, and I'm gonna do that to stimulate discussion. So whether you agree or don't agree with me, we would like to hear your opinion and liven up the discussion section. So I will try to be as brief as possible so that all of your questions can get answered. So we have found from these studies that very consistently that overweight increases among children from Mexico when they immigrate to California. So as Lisa said, something's going on in California. And I think that's really the interesting piece. Why is this transition happening? Although we're also seeing increases in Mexico, probably for the same reasons. As we saw from Lisa's presentation, the food insecure in Mexico are paradoxically eating less, but are at higher risk for obesity. Eating less of many foods, and unfortunately eating less of many healthy foods. Whereas we're seeing the converse of Mexican immigrants in California, where they're actually eating more non-healthy foods, but we're not seeing the relative increase in obesity when comparing the food insecure to the food secure. And then from Mario's presentation, we're seeing that perhaps, I think it's intriguing, it'll be very interesting to see the findings later down the line, perhaps having a family member in the U.S. is increasing risk at the community level and having a differential effect on male and female children, which is very productive. So maybe protecting the males and actually increasing the risk for the females. Is that correct, Mario?
Yes. Yeah.
And then moving on to the more qualitative research, although mothers in Mexico view overweight more favorably than their counterparts in California, and there is more recognition in California that obesity is a problem and a stronger desire for thinner children, apparently these attitudes have not helped because the children in California are heavier. So I think that's a really telling story. And on both sides of the border, mothers tend to view their children as normal weight, even though most of the findings showed that they are incorrectly assessing that. But it's the same on both sides of the border, so that there's no difference in attitude there, so that attitude can't be explaining the difference in the two locations. So it does not appear that recognizing obesity as a problem is really going to help immigrants, because they get heavier when they come over here, even though they recognize it more as a problem. So these findings aren't really suggesting a solution there. And that their ability to classify their children's weight also does not seem to be helping. But there were real differences in behaviors in these two populations that I think popped up from several of these studies. Higher rates of breastfeeding in Mexico, less junk food consumption, higher levels of exercise, just to name a few, and other studies have confirmed these differences. So what does that mean for a coordinated binational approach to obesity prevention and food security? So now really jumping up to a macro level. And what I think when you take these findings all together, along with other research that this has really evolved around, we don't really need to educate, I don't think parent education about their children's weight status is the way to go. I think if you really look at Sylvia Gendelman's, Lucia Kaiser's, and Lusa's work, we can see that the findings suggest that this approach would neither resonate with this population, who doesn't look at health in terms of weight issues, nor would it be effective Rather, we really need to change the focus to an emphasis on healthy eating and physical activity, behaviors that are valued in these communities and for which they can see results that are meaningful other than weight in terms of healthfulness, in terms of social interaction, loving and caring, and that we need to support the policies and environmental factors that are driving these behaviors. Again, it's not that they need education about the values of healthy eating and activity, but rather they need the opportunities. So I would like to challenge all of you tonight to think about how can we work together binationally to preserve the healthy, health-promoting traditions in Mexico that actually protect against obesity but are rapidly disappearing in that country. I have been traveling back and forth to Mexico with my family there since the 1970s, and I have seen an evolution happening, a major transformation happening in that country. It's looking more like the U.S. all the time. There's always a new U.S. or international chain store propping up in Mexico. What I would like, some of the protective things that I'm seeing that are disappearing in Mexico are tianguis, the fresh, where fresh whole foods are available in an outdoor market, easily accessible to everyone in the neighborhood, financially accessible. We call them farmers markets here, but when I go to Mexico, they're like, what? You're trying to preserve farmers markets? That's just always been the way that it's done. Preserving that sort of thing. Preserving what I would call traditional Mexican fast food, the tacos Mexican style, not American style, not Taco Bell style tacos, instead of traditional Mexican fast food. But how many of you have seen the transformation from taco stands in Mexico to hamburguesas? We're seeing this transformation happening. Also, transportation systems that really make it possible for you to get all around. In Mexico City, you can get anywhere on public transportation. People don't have to rely on cars, and unfortunately, they also can't afford them. And then children playing outdoor. We've seen a really transformation in a cultural norm shift. Lisa and I were talking about how even though they perceive the neighborhoods here, the neighborhoods in Mexico is more dangerous, children are allowed to play outdoors much more frequently than they are here. When they move to the U.S., the cultural norm is, oh, it's too dangerous to go outside. And on the U.S. end, we can really work to de-glamorize the aspects of modernization, such as unhealthy food and sedentary lifestyle, that really get glamorized and have a particular appeal to an immigrant population who may view these as signs of success and incorporate these practices and be even more susceptible to the aggressive marketing tactics, trying to make these foods sound like this is success, this is your opportunity to give your child everything that you never had back home. So to work on the marketing factors. So I think in conclusion, it is really an environmental and policy approach that is going to have effect in changing the institutional policies, government policies, and marketing policies that are promoting obesity and specifically targeting immigrant Latino populations in California. So with my challenge, then, I'd like to open this to your own discussions about what you think the policy implications of this research is, and of course, any specific questions you might have about any of the individual studies that were presented. Thank you. We don't have a microphone for questions, right? No. Okay. So you can just raise your hand if you have a question, either a specific question about one of the studies or your own suggestions regarding the actual policy implications of this work.
And body weight according to the BMI of the mother.
No, but that is, would be a very good follow-up because I think that it's a strong antecedent, a strong risk factor for how they perceive their own kids. Because some of the focus group responses were, well, you know, I'm overweight, so how can I expect my child not to be overweight? Or my sister says that her children are overweight, but that's okay because she wants them to be like her. If not, again, is it an issue of poor mothering, that it reflects bad mothering or what? So These are very interesting issues that need to be touched on future research.
Regarding the policy issue, I have worked with the Mexican American population in Texas, specifically in the Indian of Houston, Texas, where we 76% of our Hispanic population is from Mexican ancestry. And one of the things, the common topics that have come out of focus groups and qualitative analysis specifically, is the modeling of behaviors. In general, we always either promote healthy behaviors that don't seem to sink into the population, or we promote environmental changes that go beyond budget-wise of what in reality we can achieve easily. But what seems to have resonance into the community, coming from the community, is this idea of parents modeling exercise and healthy eating to their own children. And they have this sense that if my children do what I do and they eat what I eat, so the idea in terms of policy that is not only teaching them what is good or bad for them, but teaching them that the kids should do what they do.
I'm seeing lots of nods. I think a lot of people are agreed. And I think it's an excellent approach. I think it's a very appealing to appeal to the parents in terms of doing it for your children. It's a lot harder for adults to lose weight and maintain weight loss. So to realize that you can model and healthy eating behaviors and physical activities no matter what your own body size is, to encourage the mothers is not necessary for them to lose weight, to be good role models, to empower them. And of course, I think in this community in particular, the idea of doing it for your children is a very motivating thing, and to know that it can really make a difference. So I think that's an excellent approach. And I don't know if anyone else had a comment to make. Okay, thank you. Yes, Alicia.
There, we found that food security was strongly correlated with lower height for age. So I'm wondering, in your population that's overweight, whether it's a combination of both stunting, because the food that they're not eating are the dairy foods and meats and things that would promote linear growth. So have you been able to see whether that's what's going on in Mexico, where the lower amount of the calcium intakes are affecting
the growth? Yeah, I think looking at direct association with food insecurity and stunting, I actually have a pretty low prevalence of stunting in this population, and perhaps because they're part of opportunity of it now. They were all participants in it. But we could definitely look at the concurrent kind of obesity in ones that are stunted and obese and see if that was associated with food insecurity. That was a really good idea.
Or just even, lower height, even if they're not classically stunted.
Okay,
not even below the just smaller, shorter children.
Can everyone hear the speakers in the back, or should they come up to the mic? Everyone can hear them. Okay. There was a comment in the back, yes.
Really have a healthy lifestyle. I mean, open space is next to nothing in those areas. It's not safe to go outside and get physical activity in most of those areas. And there's a real lack of stores that cater to fresh produce, fruit and vegetables, healthy food. And if there are, they can afford it, or it's at least priced what Del Taco is or whatever is down the street. And so something that a council member, not in the county, she's from LA City, she imposed, she put forth a motion to impose a moratorium on fast foods in Southeast LA, which it's, major area where Latinos reside. So that's been one thing that's been done on the local level, because the state is sometimes slower to respond. And there are quite a bit of different efforts in Los Angeles County now, but it has to start at the policy level, at the higher level, to really change.
Mm-hmm. And our some other focus groups that we had done at our center confirmed actually a fairly high level of consciousness among Latino communities, other communities of colors, about resentment, about only having junk food, convenience stores around, having so much tobacco and alcohol for sale, not... what is it? I think it was America Bracho, you know, showing the picture of the kids in the apartment complexes playing in the garbage bins because they didn't have any other place to play. That, you know, clearly this is having a big impact, and we're seeing it in the results of these studies where this high intake when they get to California of more junky foods because they're cheaper foods and they're more accessible.
I think you raised really interesting questions, and there's one point that I want to sort of talk about that I couldn't do in my presentation for lack of time, but I am a little leery about romanticizing too much about the protective behaviors back home based on some of the findings from our focus groups, and it has to do probably with what Gail was sort of telling us that we all know that things are changing very rapidly in Mexico. But in our study, moms, particularly in rural California, were telling us, you know, we certainly face a lot of barriers to eating well here, and there are the temptations of the higher income, as I was explaining, that leads to you can get more fast food, blah, blah, blah. But they were also saying, you know, we now that as we become more aware of these issues are a little leery when we go back to Mexico and realize how many tortillas people eat. And then they were saying, and we have to undo certain behaviors that we learned from our mothers and abuelitas, such as we have to eat everything that is in your plate, and you've got to teach your kids to eat everything, no matter if they're not hungry. You just finish that. It's a matter of respect and politeness and remembering those days when we didn't, when there was scarcity or didn't have that. So I don't think that we can easily just romanticize that even the olden days were the golden days, you know? So that was one of the things that I wanted to bring up.
I just put a comment. Where you saw the conference of obesity as a responsibility today, as an individual responsibility. That was very good conference, and that give us a very, very good view of how the environment is really attacking people, and this environment is making children fatter and everyone fatter. And this is happening, of course, as part of this nutrition transition, even in poor communities and in poor areas as we saw. Another presentation, interesting presentation that I saw is how we eat automatically. And that in relation to this issue of cleaning your plate, and people were served soup continuously, and then they didn't notice, and when they look at it, they had consumed 12 bowls of soup within a dinner. So we have to work on all these issues, environmental issues, even in rural areas.
I think before we conclude, should I take two more questions? Would that be okay? Nestor, did you have your hand raised?
Actually, I just had a comment. If you have any specific policy implications that you can suggest, in particular binational policies, based on what has been presented.
Well, I can share one. I can share one possibly. I think from looking at food insecurity, both sides of the board really need to think about ways we can address food insecurity. I mean, there's unhealthy results of food insecurity on both sides, different but equal in California and in Mexico. And I think programs like WIC, which clearly a lot of them are involved in, and programs like Open Comunidad that came to increase their access to fresh fruits and vegetables and healthy foods, that food insecurity families really need.
I'm assuming that it's very important to work with health professionals about how we could transmit information with health pressure. And as Sam was to say to you that when we back to the community in Ventura to share the results about this city, I was talking for 40 minutes about obesity, the risk, and all the results. And when I jumped, the first question from one mother was, well, what is obesity? How will we call identify what child has obesity? Maybe it's very clear for us, but I think the one policy that is very important is to work about what tools we need as professionals, as care professionals, for work with the community, and that is very important.
And there was one more question over here. Yes?
Talked about promoting healthy behaviors, and I was thinking about things like having the community come together and do things like healthy potlucks, healthy play, inviting programs like the Spark program to get children to play. And what I like about some of those programs is working with the parents and the children and the whole community. So it might be a little bit naive to say that we're going to, you know, change behaviors overnight, but I think that we have to get away from the individual level at this point, and the environmental barriers are going to be there, and while we're trying to change them, I wonder if we can still do other practical things.
Yeah, I think excellent suggestions, and I think many of them are being implemented in California. I'm working on two initiatives. One is the Healthy Eating, Active Living initiative funded by Kaiser Permanente, and the Healthy Eating, Active Communities funded by the California Endowment. In those, and in many schools all across California, they're implementing Spark. They're changing the menus at the schools. They're getting out of the business of selling junk food as a way to sell money, and we are starting to come up with the results showing it does make a difference. Physical activity in 1 year, you can slow down the rate of increase in overweight. There's several studies now demonstrating that. So I think you're right. I think we can make long-term policy goals, and then we can do these shorter-term problems to get some really quick wins. And that's what we're really encouraging with our community is that combined approach. Do some quick, a little bit more educational classes type of thing that gives you some really quick wins. The community sees results. They get together. Long-term policy changes, redesigning our communities at the same time really seems to be the combination that can be very effective. And almost all of these projects are working in primarily Latino communities in California.
Not talking about
what I'm going to say based on my study, but I think that I am a Michael Pollan follower insofar as what we haven't talked about is really the food industry and how do you change that? How do you understand the fact that Mexico is the number one consumer of Coca-Cola in the world? And so it's no surprise that what you Mario was showing, was it Mario or you were showing about the consumption of sodas in this population. I mean, again, we tend to think about chicken and how much protein you should eat and that you should eat a little bit of meat, but it's very different if that meat is coming from corn-fed cows and chickens that is very marble food compared to what you could eat if that meat came from more organic, more industries that really feed their animals, not based on the need for them to grow in 18 months quickly so that you can sell it at a good price. So I think that those are issues that are really going to be important for both countries and where we really need to sort of work collaboratively to advocate for food industries.
And I think all of these policies have great binational implications. Think how powerful it would be if Mexico and the U.S. were getting some consensus and attacking these big issues, doing the programmatic stuff, doing this policy work. If we could get a coordinated agenda, the impact, I think, could really be tremendous. And let's, for those of you who want to hang on a little bit longer, Mario, did you want to add a comment? No? Okay, then Lucia.
Yes, precisely in relation of these unexpected findings that we observed that migration of a parent affected more girls than boys, we thought about that kind of issues, how this disruption of the integrity of the family could affect differently boys and girls. Maybe this have, of course, an emotional impact on children, and maybe girls are turning into more food or, you know, so those are issues that we have to address. Yeah.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank the audience for their very insightful comments and questions. What a great discussion. I think there's a lot of potential for action. And thanks very much to the speakers for the fantastic research that they're doing. Good night, everyone.
And my major research is basically with Mexican American population.